Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. For the hour today, we discuss the indispensable role of critical education and a vibrant free press in resisting the ghost of fascism in the Trump era. We are joined for the hour by renowned educator, prolific author, and public intellectual Henry A. Giroux. Stay with us for an information-packed hour with Henry Giroux. But my people getting tired of the pain and the shame. We're not commodities or cogs that turn the global economy. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we are delighted to welcome back the wonderful author and scholar Henry Giroux. Henry Giroux is a world-renowned educator, author, and public intellectual. He currently holds the Professorship for Scholarship in the Public Interest and the Paulo Freire Distinguished Scholar Chair in Critical Pedagogy at McMaster University in Canada. His most recent books include The Violence of Organized Forgetting by City Lights, Neoliberalism's War on Higher Education from Haymarket, Disposable Futures, also at City Lights, Dangerous Thinking from Routledge, America's War with Itself, another title on City Lights. He is a prolific writer and political commentator. He has appeared in a wide range of media, including Truthout, Salon, Counterpunch, The New York Times, and Bill Moyers and Company. He's currently in Ontario, Canada, and lives with his wife there. And Henry Giroux also writes a lot at Truthout and has been on the Project Censored Show before. His forthcoming book from City Lights is called American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism. Henry Giroux, welcome back.
Always a delight to be on this program.
So, Henry Giroux, let's start with current events, and then I guess we can go both back and forward. You did a piece at Truthout. Violence is in the DNA of American society, and you were talking about gun violence and administration agendas. I just wanted to jump in here because we can go so many other places from here, but this is definitely something that's now more on people's minds, which I suppose is both good and bad. Bad for obvious reasons. Good because it's high time we do something about this culture. Can you weigh in on a little of this?
Well, I think it's particularly good because I think the effort at sort of mobilizing passions and insights around this recent mass shooting is coming from young people, which I think is fabulous. I mean, I think that young people are starting to realize that most adults have failed them and that they've been written out of the discourse of democracy. They're seen as voiceless and disposable in excess. They're not seen as a long-term investment anymore in this brutal sort of capitalist social order in which we find ourselves. And I think that they're raising fundamental questions about not only simply gun violence, but about violence in general, and particularly how that violence impacts on young people. One of the things that I hear them saying is that you need to address the broader context of violence. Yes, we can start with banning assault weapons because nobody in the world should have assault weapons except soldiers. But also, I think what they're doing is they're calling out these politicians who basically have blood on their hands, in my estimation, because in many cases, they're just bought and sold by the gun lobby. Marco Rubio is a disgrace. Rick Scott is a disgrace. You know, the usual response to these unbelievable killings and these sad, and tragic acts of murderous rage is that, well, we can't really talk about that right now. It's too political. We don't want to politicize this. Are you for real? Of course it's political. You know, you've got the NRA as the fourth arm of the government, and it just bought and sold people as if they were just puppets. And so it seems to me that what these young people are doing is saying, look, this is not a moment, this is a movement. And we're going to sort of mobilize young people all over the country because we're tired of being killed because certain right-wing extremist elements at both the highest levels of government and at the state level refuse to not be bought and sold by the gun lobbies.
And Henry Giroux, what you say resonates so much, and we've been talking about this for quite a while at Project Censored because we work with so many students and young people, is that this is a young people's response. We've seen young people mobilize around climate change. We've seen young people mobilizing around misogyny and patriarchy and the Me Too campaign. We've seen young people at the core of Black Lives Matter and so many other social justice movements. And now we're seeing a tipping point in the long-standing, decades-long of wanton gun violence in the United States. We're now seeing young people really pick up that cause, and they're saying, we will not tolerate our students, our comrades, our friends being mowed down while other political figures with NRA funding send truckloads of thoughts and prayers and do very little else.
The real issue here for these kids is to make the larger connections. And I think that's what they're trying to do. I mean, what we're talking about here is we're talking about something fundamentally essential to any analysis of the wider forces, the broader context of violence in the United States, and that is capitalism is deadly. It's deadly. It has nothing to do with democracy in its existing forms. It's absolutely violated the social contract, and that it mobilizes violence not simply in the most obvious sense of that's now increasingly becoming normalized, mass shootings and everyday killings, but it's normalized violence throughout the culture, whether we're talking about violence against women's bodies and reproductive rights, whether we're talking about violence against the planet, whether we're talking about the violence that's being waged every day in the usurpation of public goods, in the destruction of public goods, the violence that takes place when right-wing politicians poison the water in Flint, Michigan, and other places in order to save money, particularly when they do it with populations that they think are disposable, primarily poor black populations. So it seems to me that we need to expand this culture of violence to understand it, because then we can see how the threads that operate in places like Parkland actually have something in common with threads that operate among different expressions of violence in other places. By doing that, you can call a society into question in ways that are enormously powerful, and you can begin to mobilize people. It's not about whether we should take away your guns. It's about whether you want to live in a democracy or not. That's the real issue we're dealing with here. Do you want to live in a fascist state, or do you want to live in a democracy? And I think that talking about fascism in this way today and the echoes of fascism is hardly an exaggeration. All you have to do is look at the person who's in office right now, the way he surrounds himself with neo-Nazis, the way he basically obviously is undoing almost every democratic institution that matters in the United States. And so it goes on and on. And I think that that discourse is very interesting to me. And I just hope the young people can keep up the energy. You know, it's interesting, right, Mickey, because it's one thing to go after other adults, as Trump has done. You know, fake news, stupid, losers. It's hard to say that about children.
Indeed it is, Henry. And we're going to talk a lot more about fascist culture, and that's something that you've been writing a lot more about. So, Henry Giroux, you're making these connections, right? And you're talking about, again, this is the context and this is the contents of so many of your books. We're seeing dot connecting going on, but you're also connecting these dots to capitalism, to fascism. And this brings us to another piece that you wrote not long ago, The Ghost of Fascism in the Age of Trump, right? And you talk about this, you connect a lot of the dots that are going on here. And you talk about this. Tell our listeners a little bit more about what you mean about the ghost of fascism.
What I was trying to say in that piece is that historical memory and historical consciousness counts for something. And when you live in a society in which memory is constantly being either reconfigured in the interest of capital and demagogues, or it's being obliterated, as it is in some schools where certain things are being censored and certain books can't be read, Howard Zinn's People's History, for instance, as you well know. You know this better than I do. I think that what we fail to realize is that, you know, history teaches us something. We need to learn from history. There are incidents there that basically bear down on the way in which people both deal with fascism, the way it's emerged, and how, in fact, it can be addressed. And I think that oftentimes people tend to think that fascism or certain historical moments are sort of frozen in history. That history is like a frozen notebook. You just go back and you say, yes, that happened in 1933. We don't have to worry about that. But I think the real issue I was trying to get at is that in what way does the history of fascism, Nazism, dictatorships, oppressive regimes, in what way do they offer signposts that allow us to recognize that something very similar to what went on in the 1930s and 1970s and 1940s is actually happening today? And I'm particularly concerned because, you know, we live in a very different kind of moment historically, because the great educators are now not the schools. The great educators is really the digital and mass culture, mainstream culture, and mainstream media. And education has become so central to politics at a time when everything is caught up in the culture of immediacy, the culture of consumerism, and the culture of self-interest, that history all of a sudden becomes an anachronism. You know, it has nothing to teach us anymore. This is not about the cliche, if you don't learn from history, you don't learn anything. But it is about the fact that something is happening in this country that's happened before in the United States, and we need to take very seriously what the signposts are, what kind of language is being echoed that we've heard before, what kind of policies are being put in place that we've heard before, what kinds of power is being mobilized that are similar to something that we have seen in the past, whether we're talking about the attack on the press, whether we're talking about the attack on independent aspects of the government, whether we're talking about the attack on the courts. I mean, this is not new. And I think they consider this new and to not be attentive to what's being reproduced here in different forms is not to recognize that fascism can take different forms and crystallize into different social formations, and that many people have talked about this. And one of the things I talked about in the piece was that there have been many warnings in both fiction and nonfiction and theoretical works by historians who are saying, look, something is going on here that we need to be attentive to, whether we're talking about Trump's winking at neo-fascists, whether we're talking about the rise of white supremacy or white nationalism, whether we're talking about the apotheosis of the Republican Party as a party of racists and power-mongering social formations that operate in the interest of the financial elite. All these things have roots somewhere else and echo a time in history that we really don't want to repeat.
And, you know, you brought up Howard Zinn and the People's History, and certainly that book's been on a number of censored lists, and there have been concerted efforts from governors down to try to ban the book and ban the teaching in schools. And, of course, you write this in another one of your pieces, that the U.S. was born out of acts of genocide, nativism, and ongoing violence of white supremacy. So, once again, the history is very crucial, very important. It provides context. And as you say, this is nothing new. It perhaps has different machinations or a different specific manifestation. But these are things that are really rooted in our culture, and we should be able to respond to them in a way that is informed by civic literacy. But again, as you wrote in another piece, challenging Trump's language of fascism from earlier in January, you rightly said that the language of civic literacy and democracy has given way to the language of saviors, decline, bigotry, and hatred, including thought crimes are now labeled as fake news. And that was one of the really big memes from the Trump campaign about fake news and that the press is the enemy of the American people.
I think that in some way, Orwell, his Ministry of Truth has now become the Ministry of Fake News, right? I mean, Trump has sort of undone something fundamental to any democracy, the ability of people to take the notion of truth and evidence and science, scientific research seriously. Because it seems to me that when you can't make a distinction between fiction and reality, then you can't believe anything. And if you can't believe anything, then basically you can't commit to anything and you can't critique anything. And all of a sudden you become part of a herd that's being mobilized like soft jelly. As Dewey said, you don't have an informed public, you don't have a democracy. And he was right. And I think that one of the things that's enormously scary about this is the way in which certain elements of a democratic language are disappearing and being matched by social formations that utterly isolate and antagonize people. For instance, democracy is not talked about. You don't hear the word democracy. You don't hear the word community. You don't hear people talking about solidarity. Compassion has become, in many ways, a term of abuse. You don't hear people talking about the public good. The social contract now, it operates on the same level as some sort of, you know, poisonous virus. The language of individual responsibility has replaced the language of government responsibility and the welfare state. And it seems to me that as that language has been transformed, so have social relationships been transformed. Fascism, like democracy, begins with words. It begins with language. It mobilizes into ideas. It becomes embodied in social institutions. It's advocated by intellectuals. All of those things are now under attack in the United States. And it's created forms of education and a formative culture that is as toxic as it is anti-democratic. And I think this is something that we have to realize. Atomization is the and thoughtlessness are the essence of fascism, the essence, as many people have argued, including Hannah Arendt.
Indeed. And again, that's a big part of the focus of your newest book coming from City Lights. And we definitely want to talk more about that forthcoming release in this program. Your newest book coming out called American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism. But again, you've written a lot about this. And in your Challenging Trump's Language of Fascism piece for Truth Out from January 9th of 2018, again, you say forthrightly that an Orwellian nightmare vision of the future is not fiction. And you say that this Ministry of Truth has become the Ministry of Fake News. The language of newspeak has multiple platforms and is morphed into a giant disimagination machinery of propaganda, violence, bigotry, hatred, and war. And all of this is on the backdrop of where we started the conversation, with the school shootings and so on. But I wanted you to remind our listeners of what do you mean by disimagination machinery? Because you've written about as the part of a book in the past.
When I talk about the disimagination machines, I'm talking about a whole range of platforms, basically in the digital world and in the mainstream media, that do everything they can to undo any sense of the truth, that basically have become complicit in the same way that the Vichy regime made people complicitous, with actually the worst dimensions of a kind of ruthless, rabid capitalism. I was so upset the other day after watching this 60 Minutes program where they were talking about gun violence as if there were just two sides of the issue. You know, there are people who are advocating everybody should have a concealed weapon and be able to cross state lines, and there are people who aren't. Well, I'm sorry. There aren't two issues here. One issue operates in the language of violence, self-interest, and corporate profits, and the other says that guns basically should have nothing to do with solving the problems that we have to face. That's what a democracy is about. And I think that what we constantly see in these disimagination machines is the normalization and the depolitization of people, whether it's through the language of lifestyles, whether it's through celebrity culture with all of its idiocy, whether it's through a consumer culture that says the only obligation of citizenship is to shop, or whether it's through this utter privatization that runs through the culture like a cancer. Like a cancer, you know? I mean, we can't talk about serious issues without degenerated into a kind of Oprah Winfrey discourse, a discourse of lifestyles. Are you happy? You know, are you buying goods? Disregard the fact that the planet is under siege and that species are being wiped out. The ice caps are melting. The sea is rising. I mean, these are not minor issues. The United States or the world in many ways stands on the brink of a potential nuclear war and climatic extinction. And yet, we're talking about Trump's relationship with a porno star. I don't want to hear about his affairs with porno stars. I want to hear about his affairs with the fossil fuel industry.
And Rex Tillerson and the carving up of the planet, both under Hillary Clinton at the State Department with fracking, now handed directly over to the former CEO. And not only that, I hate to bring this in, and we'll have to take a break here momentarily, but there's a tremendous infatuation with so-called Russiagate, again, that is also potentially a distraction from many things that actually matter in terms of the decay of democratic institutions in the United States, including the press and education. We're speaking with the renowned scholar and author Henry Giroux. His latest book forthcoming at City Lights is called American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism. I'm Mickey Huff. You're listening to the Project Censored Show. We'll continue our conversation with Henry Giroux after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff. On today's program, we are joined for the hour by Henry Giroux, who's a world-renowned educator, author, and public intellectual. He currently holds the professorship for scholarship in the public interest and the Paulo Freire Distinguished Scholar Chair in Critical Pedagogy at McMaster University in Canada. His latest book, which is forthcoming at City Lights, is called American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism. And Henry, before the break, you were talking about the disimagination machine, and you were talking about a culture and a press and a political dialogue that seems to be driven by personality, that's driven by inanity, sensationalism. If we go back to the 1960s, the American historian Daniel Boorstin wrote a book in the early 1960s called The Image, A Guide to Pseudo-Events in America. And he talked about these pseudo-events, these made-for-television events, and defined celebrity as someone known for their well-knownness. And that's really the Trump reality star turned politician kind of situation that we're actually facing, where he has lured in much of the media and the Fourth Estate and others that are allegedly holding those in power accountable to the public. And now they're all part of the same charade.
There's a couple of things that are interesting here that you've raised that I would like to elaborate on. First of all, unlike 40 years ago, the relationship between power, culture, politics, and everyday life is more powerful than anything we've ever seen. And I think so powerful that we can actually claim that we're now in a paradigm shift. that education has become so central to politics, soft power, and its ability to shape agencies, desires, motivations, modes of identification, and preferences. We've never seen anything like this. This culture is instant, it's powerful, it's fast, it cuts across boundaries, and it's completely new. This is a new political register in my mind, and that has to be named. The second thing is that there are two sides to this culture, if I could be simplistic for a moment. At one level, there's a side that's utterly stupid and idiotic, and its main purpose is to basically normalize a kind of civic illiteracy that basically turns people into consumers, consumers of lifestyles, consumers of other people's identities, and consumers of goods. That's one side. But there's another side. And the other side is a side that is terrifying, equally terrifying. And that's a side based on the culture of cruelty and the culture of hate. And I think that what we see increasingly, as I said, I think in my last piece, I mean, all of a sudden, what people are not talking about is we don't just have a corporate-controlled media, five or six companies controlling 85% of the media. We have a media largely controlled by the right wing. I mean, we're talking about Rupert Murdoch. You know, we're talking about Clearwater, which dominates the airwaves, owning, as I said in the piece, over 1,250 stations. We're talking about Sinclair Broadcast Group, which owns the largest number of TV stations in the United States. We're talking about Rush Limbaugh. We're talking about Hannity. We're talking about InfoWars. I mean, this media has now created an ecology that is so at odds with any sense of compassion and justice and community and solidarity that it poses one of the most powerful pedagogical threats to democracy that we have ever seen.
Well, Henry Giroux, let's riff on that for a moment. You mentioned going back 40 years. Let's go back to the early 70s when we had the Nixon administration in the United States, Richard Nixon and Vice President Spiro Agnew's famous or infamous speech on the nattering nabobs of negativism and the attacks on the press, and back actually when the New York Times maybe had a few teeth left in it, in the time of the Pentagon Papers, and a time when there was a serious shift, right, coming out of the 1960s, that the Republican establishment and the Chambers of Commerce, the Lewis Powell memo, these forces all basically said, we have to fight back against the populace. We have to fight back against these civil rights and these civic literacy movements. And we have to attack the public institutions from government to media. And we have to basically deconstruct them, defang them, and replace them with our own propaganda instruments. And almost half a century later, I'd have to say, based on the rundown that you just gave us, you know, including Robert Mercer's former backing of Breitbart.com, et cetera, we're in an entirely different landscape. And you called it a paradigm shift. And I would argue that actually really is coming out of that period. And I hate to say this, and I don't mean to sound cynical, because I think there's definitely hope and there are people working to reverse this, you being one of the big ones. But what can you say other than that these people have been largely successful in their endeavors?
I'm with you. I mean, I'm pessimistic intellectually, and I'm optimistic in terms of the future. But they won. I mean, they took education enormously seriously, whether we're talking about the Powell memo, as you mentioned, or the Trilateral Commission, commentary on the excess of democracy. They saw something happening that frightened them to death. They saw the universities rise up in the 1960s and all of a sudden become enormously powerful pedagogical engines of the possibility for radical change. They saw diverse groups coming into the university that would vote in a very different way. They saw democracy being expanded in terms of access, substance, and representation. And they have never gotten over this. Never. I mean, think about what they've done, as you've just said. They now have these massive conservative foundations that are bankrolled by people like the Koch brothers. They've invaded the universities. First, they corporatized it. Now they're politicizing it in ways we've never seen before. Thirdly, it seems to me that they smother the airways with hate, anti-immigration, nonsense, the worst kind of educational information in which education is on the side of tyranny and nativism. They have their own anti-public intellectuals. I don't call them public intellectuals. I call them anti-public intellectuals because that's basically what they are. And they're everywhere. Thank God for the alternative media because we see Chomsky at least on once in a while. But Jay's not on NBC. He's not on CBS. He's not in the mainstream media. The mainstream media is dominated by right-wing anti-public intellectuals. And I find that horrifying. And I think that until the left, in all of its multiple fragmented forms, begins to take this question of education as being central to politics, we're in big trouble. Because we need three things. One, we need moments that become movements. But for that to happen, we need to change people's consciousness. You cannot have a radical social movement or a critical social movement if people don't know what the hell you're talking about. If they can't identify with your language in a way that enables them to understand the conditions of their own oppression more critically and more reflectively. Secondly, you need public spheres to do this. Ideas can't exist outside of public spheres. It just is not going to happen. They'll just disappear and get undercut in the disimagination machines. Thirdly, you need to begin with the presupposition that if education is central to politics, then we've constantly got to be using the alternative media wherever we can, the mainstream media, to do everything we can to educate people. But we've got to do that in a way by creating a larger, what I would call rhetorical umbrella that would allow all these different threads, these fragmented moments, to come together by looking at the thread that holds them together, that they all have in common. And what they all have in common is a violence against democracy. We need to talk about a radical, democratic, socialist democracy. We have to go back to what that means. And the measure for all of these movements has to be the degree to which they validate, invalidate, undercut, or at odds with what we would call a real substantive democracy.
And what we've seen, Henry Giroux, not just in the past week or so around gun violence, but in the past several years, we've seen the younger generation, millennial generation, really embracing socialist principles, unlike my generation, I guess, the Gen Xers were so were called, I guess, whatever that's supposed to mean. And not unlike your generation, Henry Giroux, but I think we skip a generation here. It is true. This is why there was such a violent reaction from the right wing and the conservative political establishment in the 1970s, is because in the 1960s in the United States, there were some gains made.
There were enormous gains. And not only that, there were multiple battles being waged on multiple fronts that all used the word democracy. The civil rights movement talked about democracy. The Port Huron Statement talked about democracy. I mean, democracy was the word. And you had the Trilateral Commission. They talked about the excess of democracy. And I think that one of the things that's so interesting in light of what we're talking about is, remember, right now all over Europe, you have the rise of what they're calling illiberal democracies, claiming that a democracy doesn't have to be liberal to be a democracy. One instance of that just took place the other day in Poland, where they passed a measure claiming that it's a crime now if anybody writes or says anything publicly suggesting that Poles had anything to do with the genocide of Jews. I mean, we're all of a sudden seeing democracy being so undermined by the disimagination machines that it actually becomes a synonym for authoritarianism.
Indeed, you're correct, Henry Giroux. And we've seen this happen in Japan with the Korean sex slave women of World War II. We're seeing it in Poland now. We've seen it in Ukraine. We've seen it in other parts of Europe. We see it in the United States. We mentioned earlier the attacks on Howard Zinn and the People's History and the efforts to thwart and suppress those narratives in public schools. We saw the banning of ethnic studies and other kinds of important study in Arizona and New Mexico and other places that, of course, have been combated. And we have fought back against those forces. But, you know, we're seeing an entire reinvention of the definitions of democracy that have been completely unmoored and severed from anything that would resemble even the sort of tepid endorsement of democratic practice we saw among the founders of this country 240 years ago.
You can't have a democracy without civic literacy. It's just impossible. It's not going to happen. And secondly, you've got to have a democracy that is built on a vision, even in its most negative moments when it says no society is ever just enough. I mean, that's a vision that says that human suffering shouldn't take place. That's a vision that says that the government is not about simply helping the interests of the financial elite, but provides the basic social provisions that allow people to live through a social wage, meaningful work, good public goods, free health care. I mean, somehow this notion of freedom has been so distorted, so individualized, so corrupted, that it becomes impossible to think about a social ethic or notions of solidarity that would be able to call into question both the institutions that reproduce it and the agents that take advantage of it.
Henry Giroux, I'd like to continue that part of the conversation and talk a little bit more about education. Once we do another brief identification, I'd like to remind listeners, you're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We're joined today for the hour by Henry Giroux, who currently holds the McMaster University Chair for Scholarship in the Public Interest in the English and Cultural Studies Department and the Paulo Freire Distinguished Scholar in Critical Pedagogy. We will be back and continue that conversation with Henry Giroux after this brief musical break. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We are joined today by Henry Giroux. Henry Giroux is the author of 60-some books. His most recent is called American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism. It's forthcoming by City Lights Books. And Henry Giroux, before this break, we were talking about civic literacy. And I want to focus a little bit on this and maybe we'll try not to descend into too much of a jargonesque conversation about critical pedagogy. But I mean, I think the elements and the concepts of critical pedagogy are so central to what you were just saying that I wanted to ask you, could you break down these concepts of critical pedagogy and why education is so important? And these are the kind of curriculum that we should be designing to help the next generation of people really, really wage these struggles.
Critical pedagogy basically begins with the assumption that education is linked to the creation of critically engaged citizens, that it has a role to play in not only educating people in terms of the various intellectual traditions, the best of those traditions and how they can be appropriated and understood and reflected upon, but also what it means to educate students about power and how to hold it accountable, how to talk about social responsibility, how, in fact, to teach them to take risk, to entertain discussions outside of their own common sense assumptions, how, to, in the face of knowledge that they may be uncomfortable with, to learn to step back and engage in critical dialogue so they can strengthen their own positions and not sort of treat them as sacrosanct, but treat them with reverence and respect by being able to critically interrogate them. I mean, I think the whole foundation for critical pedagogy is to say that pedagogy should teach people how to think. It should teach people how to care about other human beings. It should teach people how to be socially responsible. It should teach people that justice matters in their lives. It should teach people in some fundamental way that we are interconnected in a society, that we're not alone, and we can't treat ourselves as being alone, that certain values are crucial to democracy, and those values should be talked about. We should educate young people to be able to be literate in multiple platforms, in digital culture, in print, in a whole range of things, because they should learn how to be border crossers. They should be able to embrace and put things together that ordinarily are not put together. And they should learn how to think relationally. They should learn how to make connections between different elements of a problem. When they talk about the attack on public schools, they should be able to link that to the rise in the military budget or basically the defunding of public goods by certain financial interests. So it seems to me that what that kind of pedagogy does is raise fundamental questions about how knowledge is produced, whose interest it serves, what kind of social relationships go on in the classroom or anywhere else, and how do you make something meaningful to make it critical, to make it transformative. But it does one more thing. It says that teaching and learning cannot be removed from the autonomy of teachers. It says that teachers have to be able to have some control over the conditions of their labor. It says that you can't separate kids from their histories and their neighborhoods. You can work with them, and you can contest, and you can question, but you can't treat them as atomized individuals whose imaginations you can basically stomp on by simply teaching them for the test. This question of memorization, this question of standardization. You know, we have to be able to talk about pedagogies, not just simply that operate in the practice of freedom, but pedagogies that operate in the practice of fear, and pedagogies that operate in the practice of oppression, so that it becomes clear that school, teachers, the role of teachers, what goes on in classrooms, what's being taught, these are always sites of struggle. And the ultimate measure has to be whether they create the agents who are capable of closing down democracy or basically opening it up.
Well, Henry Giroux, very, very well put. And from No Child Left Behind to Race to the Top, we saw, of course, one of the architects, theoretical architects, going back to Diane Ravitch of this, that had a 180 turnaround and talked all about how this teaching to the test was a huge mistake and that we should resist this at every turn. But we've also seen the demolition of teacher unions. We've seen the lack of hiring of full-time tenured faculty. We've seen a bloated budget increase in the hiring of administrators to basically do what they did to K-12 under guided pathways. That's the latest buzzword in American community colleges and on state universities, is we need to somehow help these students navigate a system because they can't handle the cafeteria style choices or boutique courses. I mean, we're seeing a ritualistic dumbing down of all this, allegedly in Orwellian fashion, under the guise of so-called equity. What do you have to weigh in on that topic?
I think we need to be very clear about what all that means. What they're doing is waging an assault, not on schools because they're failing, but because they're public. They're waging an assault on schools as potentially democratic public spheres, and they're doing everything they can to kill the imagination of students so that they're not capable of thinking outside of the discourses that these corporate privatizers want to implant in them, which leads them to believe that schooling and training, education and training, are the same thing. They want to train people. They want to train people for the global workforce, from Nixon to Bush to Obama to this moron that's now in the White House. I mean, schooling is about educating people for the workplace. That's what it's about. Or, even worse, under people like Trump, it's about the school-to-prison pipeline, you know, educating people to basically end up in prison as the default social welfare program for poor minorities of class and color. I mean, we're seeing an attack on public and higher education, unlike we've ever seen before. And the sad and unfortunate thing is there aren't many people out there defending it.
No, there are not enough people like you, Henry Giroux, that are defending it, and people like Robert McChesney, who wrote a lot about this, and the People Get Ready, the fight against a jobless economy. He's a gem on so many levels in terms of critical media literacy, fighting censorship and propaganda. And of course, you know, I wanted to also remind listeners that your forthcoming book called American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of American Fascism, Bob McChesney said, in frightening times like these, what is desperately needed is an informed and wise voice that speaks clearly and with conviction about the situation we're in and what can be done. And of course, he's really saying that we need public intellectuals like you, Henry Giroux, and this book is for people grappling with how to understand the Trump era and how to proceed. And so, again, I can't encourage people to read your work enough, and Bob McChesney apparently agrees, but he also points out one of these issues is that preparing people for this school-to-prison pipeline, as you said, rather than have it be for critical faculty or critical thinking, it's training people for the workplace. But increasingly, we know technologically that there are fewer jobs, and artificial intelligence could be replacing all of those jobs inside of 10 years.
And not only that, even these corporate elite, you know, are screaming for people who can write, screaming for people who can think. Sorry, I mean, even at the highest levels of entrepreneurship, you got to be able to think. You can't be just a moron. You know, I mean, I remember my friend Stanley Aronowitz talking about how he would constantly at CUNY get these people coming from the elite schools, 70% of whom graduate and go into into finance. But, you know, the few who even came in critical theory or in social theory, he said they could name every theorist in the world, but they couldn't think their way through a paper bag. This guy who wrote Excellent Sheep, I think, is right, you know, in that we're seeing the death of critical education. We really are. And it's not because people don't care. It's because, for instance, what we've done in higher education is we have completely undercut the workforce by making 70% of faculty now part-time. Some of them are on food stamps. They can barely get by, and they live in fear. They live in fear because they're on one-year temporary contracts. They say something somebody doesn't like, they're gone. So you have this gulag-like culture, this corporatized gulag culture that's been imposed on higher education that really depoliticizes people. So to talk about public intellectuals, I mean, we can't talk about public intellectuals coming out of the university until we reform the university and people have jobs that allow them to have some control over the conditions of their work and free speech.
Well, right now, Henry Giroux, we're seeing an assault on academic freedom, an assault on free speech. We're seeing less and less power in a lot of faculty unions around the United States. We're basically tilting at windmills in some cases just to hold on to some of the things that we thought we perhaps had. And you also called out rightfully that we have a contingent workforce, 75% of faculty basically. Not only are they not tenured, they're not on tenure track.
The real question here is, where's the tenured faculty here? I mean, where are the people who have tenured jobs? Why aren't they speaking out? Why aren't they linking their work? I mean, there are people who are doing it. Don't get me wrong. We know that. And I guess the argument that I'm making, we just don't have enough. The real public intellectuals today are not academics. They're journalists.
And this is also by design, right? There's fewer full-time tenured faculty to speak up, but there's also now more administrative duties being heaped upon fewer tenured full-time faculty, so they have less time to be public intellectuals.
That's right.
Again, it is by design. I'm not saying it's some great conspiracy theory in a pejorative term. I'm saying that this is exactly what these folks were calling for in the early 70s.
It's being able to recognize the transformation of the university from a semi-democratic public sphere to an adjunct of corporations, of a corporate logic called neoliberalism in its most extreme form. You know, I heard the other day somebody had said about me in my own university that, well, we got to get rid of him. He's over 70 and he's stuck in the 60s.
The fact that that statement even come out as being, quote, stuck shows that disimagination machine.
And oh, absolutely. I mean, I am stuck in the 60s in the sense that I really believe that power works, that power is important, should be held accountable, that politics matters, that people should organize, that we should in some way address social justice issues regardless of the field in which we find ourselves. You know, that kind of mindset, even when coming from academics, is pathetic. Because it exhibits the degree to which they've been depoliticized and are now complicit in many ways with the very forces that will ultimately take away their jobs.
Well, Henry Giroux, I've used some of this kind of perhaps hyperbolic language, as some of my colleagues might say, quislings among the faculty that are implementing these top-down, privatized, corporate-like models for education and curriculum. And I don't necessarily believe it's hyperbolic. I believe that it's really the centerpiece of the deconstruction of having an energized, pro-democratic faculty that is teaching the next generation of people in this country what it means. And the fact that you could be accused of being stuck in the 60s shows that is the death knell. The whole purpose here is to transform higher education into a disimagination matriculation machine.
That's right. It seems to me that, as a faculty member, I have a responsibility to provide some kind of model for a younger generation, to teach them to talk back, to be self-reflective, not to be dogmatic, you know, to recognize that you can be theoretically right and be a pedagogical terrorist, so that you have to really understand what it means to get inside other people's heads, listen to them, exchange opinions, and in some way promote modes of community and solidarity that are blessed, you know, that are blessed, that bring joy, that bring commitment, that bring a sense of conviction and a sense of vision. I mean, if that's what it means to be stuck in the 60s, I guess I'm stuck in the 60s.
Yeah, I must be stuck there too, Henry Giroux, and I wasn't born until 1970. I'd like to remind listeners that we're speaking with Henry Giroux. He is a world-renowned educator, author, public intellectual. His most recent work, forthcoming from City Lights Books in San Francisco, is called American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism. You're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. When we return from our musical break, we'll conclude our interview with Henry Giroux, and I would like to turn attention to his forthcoming work, American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism. We'll be right back after this brief musical break. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we've been in conversation with Henry Giroux. He's the author of some 60 books. He is a professor of scholarship in the public interest and the Paulo Freire Distinguished Scholar and Chair in Critical Pedagogy at McMaster University in Canada. He is, again, the author of so many books, Neoliberalism's War on Higher Education, The Violence of Organized Forgetting, Disposable Futures. He's written for Truthout, Salon, Counterpunch, Bill Moyers and Company, even the New York Times, although I imagine that's fairly rare, Henry Giroux. Again, certainly a voice that needs to be heard, and I really strongly believe that your newest book, American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism, is really essential reading. I've fortunately been able to peruse an advanced copy of the manuscript that you shared, and I'd like to turn a little bit of attention to your latest work, Henry Giroux. And, you know, we were talking briefly before the program started, and I think you said that you thought that this might be your most important and maybe your best work.
I think it's a book that really takes the broad view, and it's enormously accessible. And I think it's a book that begins with a central premise that words matter, and that words basically not only matter, but the people who produce them matter, and that the social institutions that produce them matter, and all of a sudden they're disappearing. And in the midst of that disappearance, we're seeing the emergence of a fascism that has a particular and distinctive American style that we really need to address. And then what I try to do is address that, its various manifestations in a whole range of ways. You know, talking about the war on youth, talking about the war on higher education, talking about basically the emerging language of fascism, talking about the media. I mean, I particularly like the book because it connects a lot of dots. You know, it isn't just a polemic that focuses on one thing. It's also written in a style that I particularly like. I tried very hard to make this book enormously accessible while at the same time not compromising its integrity theoretically and politically. And I had a great editor for this book, Greg Ruggiero. City Lights is just a fabulous place to work with.
There's a great introduction by George Yancey at Emory University. And of course, Greg and the people at City Lights do fantastic work. And this is not your first book with them. You start out remembering Orwell's 1984 and Huxley's Brave New World. Can you talk about that conversation that you're having in the book?
What I try to do in the book is imagine a conversation in which, rather than pitting one against the other, you know, Big Brother in the surveillance state versus Huxley and, you know, the seduction through entertainment and Soma, I try to point out that they represent different registers of a new historical moment and then develop that. And actually work it through in a very interesting, not overly complex way, but in a way that sort of says, the warnings of history don't leave us. We need to take seriously what this means. And I think they become a model in some way for me.
And it starts the book out on that kind of footing. And then you go into authoritarianism and a legacy of fascist collaboration. You talk about a politics of incivility and culture of cruelty, especially manifest in Trump's America, but not because of just Trump, and right? And he's a symptom of so much that's happening. And could you take just a brief moment to talk about Trump as the symptom?
I think a lot of people are stuck on Trump as a personality. You know, he's kind of theatrical, clownish, stupid, roguish, fascistic. It's a terrible mistake. Trump is the Frankenstein monster that's been brewing in the United States for a long time. But it particularly comes to light at the end of the 1970s, when all of a sudden the welfare state crumbles and a new discourse begins to emerge, one in which a kind of corporate logic takes over and actually begins to infect and paralyze society with the most ruthless assumptions about what human life are about. Self-interest is all that matters. The market basically is the model for structuring all social relationships and not just the economy. The money should drive politics. Deregulation is all that really matters. Everything should be privatized. We should eliminate public funding, dismantle the welfare state, denigrate anybody who is involved in any sense of dependency. This is a terrible worldview. I mean, it's a worldview that is so cruel, so acrimonious in its hatred of people, so self-centered and narcissistic that what we see is not just simply a series of policies that are racist, you know, ultimately racist, anti-immigration, and so forth and so on, but it creates a formative culture that makes Trump possible. So Trump is just the end point of that culture, that's all. That culture has been educating people for a long time. Whether we want to go back to Willie Horton, or whether we want to go back to the notion that welfare queens are what drives the welfare state, or whether we want to go back to the ongoing suppression of voter rights that's been taking place, or whether we want to talk about the constant segregation in our cities, the massive inequality in wealth and power. Trump is the apostle of neoliberalism and the culture of cruelty. I mean, let's remember something. If you go back to his first episode in The Apprentice, there is a scene that I never forgot that actually reminded me of the transition from Wall Street, the film, to American Psycho, in that they show Trump in a limousine, and he's going through New York, and this camera switches to a homeless guy. And the implication is, who do you want to be? You want to be this homeless jerk who can't take care of himself? Or do you want to be like me, Trump, with my blonde hair, my women, you know, my limousine? It's a terrible, I mean, it really captures something about the way the culture has changed. I tried to talk about the politics of incivility. You know, don't raise your voice, right? In a depoliticized society, everything is about, you know, style. Don't be angry. Don't exhibit an outrage that's utterly justified because this is not a political issue. This is an aesthetic issue. That's a depoliticizing moment in any fascism that you have to address. I talk about the culture of cruelty in Trump's America. You know, I talk about something that we haven't talked about on the program, and that is what is distinctive about this era, in my estimation, is the logic of disposability. We don't just have exploitation in the old Marxist sense. We now have disposability. And I try to understand that, particularly by looking at what's happened to the Dreamers, what's happened in Puerto Rico, you know, and how it's linked to the violence in Las Vegas. This is a very complex attempt to sort of link all that stuff, then with the rise in the scourge of white nationalism and how that works, and then to somehow come to grips at the end with the neo-Nazis in Charlottesville and how to talk about the death of the Democratic Party and the need for a new party.
I was going to ask you about that, Henry Giroux, because you do have a chapter on that in your newest book. And what about the Democratic Party? Is it reformable at this juncture, given the political economy of our duopolistic structure?
No, absolutely not. The Democratic Party is a soft party of finance. The Republican Party is the party of finance with a scowl. The Democratic Party is the party of finance with a smile. They're absolutely wedded to a kind of capitalism that neither one will ever renounce. And I think in the long run, to talk about the Democratic Party as being the party of resistance to Trump really strikes me as an enormous joke. We need a third party, but we need a third party that won't talk about reforming capitalism. We need a third party that wants to abolish capitalism. We need to restructure this society according to the basic values of a society where human needs are more important than simply finance and capital. We need a society that embraces workers, embraces equality, that embraces justice, that embraces social reform, and a society driven by the need for everyone to have a life that matters rather than being involved in a life in which the only thing that matters is being able to survive.
Well, Henry Giroux, you talk again about a language. There is no democracy without informed citizens and no justice without a language that's critical of injustice.
It's one of the central tenets of the work I do, right? I really think that we have to do everything we can to in some way hold power accountable by providing a language that's useful for people, a language that people can identify with. And it's not just about the politics of meaning. It's about the politics of agency. I mean, what we're facing in the United States, and I think, Mickey, I think we've really talked about this, but we've started off talking about a crisis of memory. But a crisis of memory is about a crisis of agency. And a crisis of agency is about a crisis of politics. And all three of those crises is about a crisis of education.
Education is central to this. And as you mentioned earlier in the program, the significance not only of education, but critical media literacy education is that it's the so-called fourth estate and the so-called free press that has this primary privilege, not just obligation, to try to educate and engage, not disengage, but engage the population.
You know, behavior is learned. It's not written in our DNAs. It's learned. How did these kids in Parkville all of a sudden come up with a language that's like astounding? Saying things like, we don't care about gun reform, we want to abolish the weapons of mass destruction. They have a language that basically suggests that they've read things, they've turned to other sources, they've tried to find places where they can be informed without the propagandistic nonsense that they see all around them in the mainstream media. They're listening to programs like this. They're exchanging books and information that basically are on the border in the margins of society rather than central to society. They don't go to the New York Times to get book reviews. They're reading in places that adults are not reading.
Well, you know where they're going, Henry Giroux, is they're going online to the internet, which is exactly why Google and Facebook and other social media are now trying to algorithmically squash alternative media narratives.
That's right.
And this is a demonstrable thing. This is something that is happening. This is something that big tech has admitted to. And it's not just, you know, Cambridge Analytica on a much deeper and more nefarious level of potential public manipulation. It's happening deliberately at places like Facebook.
When these companies basically are doing everything they can in that ecosystem to squelch critical ideas, that sort of encourages, I would think, people all the more to fight for alternative media and to be able to use that media in ways that sidesteps these jerks so that things can be said, movements can be mobilized, and modes of solidarity can be reinvented that are completely at odds with the disimagination nonsense that they push.
Well, Henry Giroux, again, your forthcoming book from City Lights is called American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism. It is a strong and powerful work. Henry, can you tell people a couple websites to find your work online?
Oh, yes. I mean, I write mostly for Truth Out, and my work is republished, and a lot of it is in Truth Dig. Counterpunch publishes my work. Salon is increasingly publishing my work. I mean, I think those basic websites, you know, are websites that have been very good to me. Interestingly enough, Common Dreams never reproduces my work. And, of course, you never see my work in The Nation. So there are websites that are on the left that are also antithetical to this kind of work. But I think that the ones that have integrity, that right off the top of my head, are Truth Out, Counterpunch, Truth Dig, Salon. These are really wonderful websites.
And you also have your own website. It's henryagiroux.com. Henry, the letter A, G-I-R-O-U-X, henryagiroux.com. And, of course, people can learn about your books, your forthcoming book, at the City Lights website. Henry Giroux, thank you once again for joining us on the Project Censored Show. Give us something to look forward to, Henry.
I think that what we're seeing in the country today is a revival of the radical imagination. People are saying, hey, look, what does a democracy look like? You know, what can we do to make it happen? How do we come together? So I'm hopeful. I mean, I think that there are a lot of good people in the United States. I mean, there are people who don't believe in the racism, don't believe in the fascism, don't support the neo-Nazi nonsense. And I think that what we're seeing is a turning point. And I think in the future, we're going to look back and we're going to say, we won this battle. We won this struggle because we cared, because democracy matters, and because the future of our children matter.
Henry Giroux, again, it's always a delight to speak with you. You hold the McMaster University Chair for Scholarship in the Public Interest in the English and Cultural Studies Department and the Paulo Freire Distinguished Scholar in Critical Pedagogy, again, all at McMaster University in Canada. Your forthcoming book, American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism. You can learn more about Henry Giroux also at truthout.org. Henry Giroux, thank you again for being on the Project Censored Show. We also promote your work and repost and republish it as much as we can, and we try to get your work into the classroom with our network of educators. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Liberated land, supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
That does it for another episode of the Project Censored Show. Thanks to you, the listener, for tuning in to the Project Censored Show, which airs on over 40 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. To learn more about the Project Censored Show, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook and other social media. We'll see you next time.
About criminal minds, political ties, habitual lies, alibis, skies, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, far for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the ties with a master thief. Combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu.
We got that love with the brothers in our